Welcome to Earth Eats, a show of real food and green living. I'm Annie Corrigan.
And I'm Chef Daniel Orr.
The first thing I think people should think about before they're going to own chickens or they're going to build a house, whatever, is what are their needs and what are the yields that you're going to get from that?
Salem Willard will be one of the folks we speak with today in our chicken episode. He'll represent the rural chicken farmer, and Stephen Janowicki will represent the urban chicken farmer. Then we head into the kitchen to prepare the perfect roasted chicken. But first, here's Mia Partlow with a look at this week's news.
Congress has said no to frankenfish, at least for now. Last week's amendment bans the FDA from spending any funds on genetically engineered salmon. Aqua Bounty Technologies, the salmon's creators, has been trying to get approval for the fish for over a decade. In 2010, the FDA said the fish appeared to be safe to eat, but critics argue that not enough research has been done to determine its impact on human health, or its impact on the environment if any GM salmon were to escape into the wild. Aqua Bounty representatives view Congress's ban as a temporary setback and remain optimistic that the fish will eventually be approved. If that does end up happening, the salmon would be the first bioengineered animal approved for human consumption. American chicken farmers have been giving arsenic-laced feed to their flocks since the 1950s. 3-nitro, as it's called, kills internal parasites in chickens and makes the meat look pinker. However, new studies conducted by the FDA show that poultry lovers have reason to worry. Arsenic is a known carcinogen in its inorganic form. Yes, 3-nitro contains the less toxic organic form, but the FDA proved that chickens fed the organic stuff nevertheless demonstrated consistently higher levels of inorganic arsenic. Various consumer groups have been petitioning the FDA to ban 3-nitro since 2008. And the USDA, the Food and Agriculture Organizations of the United Nations, and the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development all agree extreme weather in 2011 will contribute to rising food prices. In the Midwest and South of the U.S., heavy rains and violent storms have crippled corn crops. Prices have already risen from $3.20 a bushel in 2010 to $7.75 a bushel in 2011. Developing nations are being affected by the weird weather most of all, where inflation and high prices have resulted in food riots. According to Oxfam International, unless the global food system changes, prices will more than double within 20 years. Read about these stories on our website, where you can add your thoughts to the discussion at eartheats.org. And follow us on Twitter and like us on Facebook to get news updates like this all week long. For Earth Eats, I'm Mia Partlow.
Just because you live in a city doesn't mean you can't grow your own food. It doesn't mean you can't compost. And it doesn't mean you can't have your own chicken flock.
It's nothing about this is hard. Everything in a yard is relatively simple as long as you know what you're doing.
We met Stephen Janowicki a few weeks back when he talked about his elaborate rain barrel system hooked up to an equally elaborate watering system for his garden. Since then, he's gotten himself 5 chickens. He built the coop and the fencing for the birds, and then went through the process of getting approval from the city to keep chickens at his house in downtown Bloomington, Indiana.
Permit to harbor a chicken flock is what you have to get. So you have to get all of your adjacent neighbors to sign waivers to say it's okay to do it. If any of your neighbors are against it, you're sunk.
Then you bake them a cake and you say pretty please.
Right, and you give them a dozen eggs every week for the next, 6 months or something. But my neighbors are great. We had no problems with that. Then the city also has a set of standards that your coop and run have to meet, which is really great. I mean, there's standards that are responsible and healthy and safe for the chickens, really. It's nothing crazy. It has to give so much space per chicken. It has to be enclosed on the top to stop hawks from coming in to get the chickens. They have to have so much space in a warm, protected enclosure for nighttime. It's just totally reasonable things. The other tricky thing about the permit is that it has to be, the coop and run have to be shielded from view. So if you see, I have a fence here. I built this fence last fall. The city requires at least a 4-foot-high visibility screen around your coop to protect them from being seen by all of the people with sensitive eyes who can't bear to look at chickens on a daily basis, I guess. That's the weird provision, but the rest is all very reasonable.
Now, know that Stephen Janowicki is referring to the laws specific to his town of Bloomington, so if you're interested in having some backyard chickens of your own, check out the rules specific to your town. If you live in a rural space, it's somewhat easier to start the process of raising your own chickens. Certainly fewer hoops to jump through. But when you see a setup like the one Salem Willard has concocted for his birds, you realize that creating a space for chickens can be as elaborate as you want it to be. Willard is an edible landscape designer, and he spoke about his permaculture project in the Hoosier National Forest a few episodes back. When I visited him in early 2011, he was constructing a chicken moat to surround his garden. There's no water involved in this moat. It's a pathway between 4 and 5 feet wide, lined with fences on both sides. The chickens then roam around the encased moat, scratching the ground, eating worms, and creating a rich compost. You've got that mental image in your head now. The chicken moat also serves to protect the garden from pests and weeds and, well, the chickens themselves, because Willard is the only one who has access to the garden and all those lovely crops. That's through a latched doorway. How many chickens do you think you're going to be able to put in here? You've got one rooster so far. Mm-hmm. What's your vision?
I'm actually going to do chickens and ducks. And so I really love this certain kind of duck called Khaki Campbell's. They lay up to 300 eggs a year, so almost every day. And I also want to get a few heritage breeds of chickens, probably total about 20 to 25 ducks and about 20 to 25 chickens.
And if you could give me like the acreage of this, because that to me sounds like a lot of birds. And this is not that big of a space, it seems like.
Yeah, it doesn't seem that big, but total, the garden area is going to be 5,500 square feet. I'm not actually sure what that is in terms of acreage, but it's fairly large. I mean, that's the size of a McMansion right there. So,
the head of the household, by the way, is the lone rooster, Abraham. First things first, when building a home for chickens, what they need is something to scratch. If you just leave them on their own, they're going to scratch the earth bare, and then there goes your healthy soil.
But if you keep throwing in things, like basically you want something like a dry carbon source, so leaves, straw, you know, you can throw out your compost as well. They'll scratch that up and they'll turn it into soil, which mixes with their manure as well. And it makes a great compost that you can then use in the garden. So, but they love eggshells. Just, I know it sounds weird.
It's weird.
It is weird. It is weird. But they really love them, and it helps recycle the calcium. You need to be sure to crush them up, because if you start getting in the habit of feeding them kind of whole eggshells, they'll start realizing that they could eat their own eggs, and you don't want that to happen. Then they would turn cannibalistic, and that would be bad.
Not pretty.
No.
Okay, back to the moat. There are these two tall fences you have to work with, so Willard says that can be turned into growing space for vines, plants like hops, if you're a homebrewer. He also planned his garden with chickens in mind by growing things that they love right along the outside of the moat. Plants like sunflowers. When those plants fall into the moat, the chickens can enjoy that bit of food, but they don't have access to the roots, which they would surely scratch into oblivion. This is a concept that permaculturists call relative location. Willard gives us an idea of other plants chickens love.
Well, there are a lot of different categories of plants. I try to divide them into cover crops, things like, you know, you could use buckwheat, rye, barley, you could do sunflowers. A lot of things like that are annuals, and those are really easy. You can kind of designate a corner of your garden and grow just that, chop it off when they get to the point where they're producing seed, and throw it in for the chickens. But that's a lot of work. You know, you have to do that every year. You have to sow the seed, and you have to raise them and then weed them and everything. So I actually promote perennial plantings. So there are a lot of shrubs that chickens will just love the fruit or the nuts that are produced by those. One is called the pea shrub, and it's a nitrogen fixer, so it's good for your garden because it fixes nitrogen, and it will drop just an abundant number of small little pea-sized pods that if you plant it alongside the moat, those fruits or those peas will drop into the moat, and then the chickens can eat them without hurting the plant. So you don't have to do any work that way. I'm a big fan of that.
Yeah, I mean, you're doing so much work anyway. If you can make your job even a little bit easier, it sounds perfect.
I like to think of it as lazy man's gardening or lazy person's gardening, just because the less work you have to do to keep everybody happy, the happier you'll be. So
I'm curious about what chickens need to be happy and healthy. You said scratching. What else?
That's a great point. I mean, chickens need company. I mean, right now I feel bad for Abraham here because he's alone, but it just so happened that he was being given away at the last minute. So they need grit. So they basically need something like shells, like oyster shells are really good because the they'll peck at those and they'll get little bits of grit, just kind of like sand-sized grains of rock even are okay. And that helps them digest in their gizzard. What else do they need? They need protection. You know, that's what the moat's doing. It's protecting them, their finstons, so that other creatures can't eat them. They need calcium, obviously, to produce eggs. So you want to provide a lot of calcium sources. That's why I also plant mulberry trees, because mulberry fruit is really high in calcium. Most people don't know that. So I plant those around the edges as well so that the fruit will fall into the moat and the chickens can eat them. I don't know. Can anybody else think of more?
Yeah, let us know if you have something to add to this. Send us an email to eartheats@gmail.com. And if you want to see a picture of Salem Willard's chicken moat, if my description didn't quite do it for you, go to the website eartheats.org. From the farm now to the kitchen, Chef Orr says that there are two tests for a new cook looking to get a job in his kitchen. First, make the perfect omelet. And then next, what we're going to do today, make the perfect roast chicken. His first bit of advice, use the best ingredients possible and cook it simply.
What I like to do is always rinse my chicken first, inside and out, and then rub it with lemon. And this is something I learned down in the islands in the Caribbean when I was in Anguilla. And any place where it seems like it's hot, like in India, whenever they're cooking birds, they always put lemon on it. And I think it's partly for sanitation reasons. The acidity is good for it, but it also creates a real crunchy, crispy skin. And you just stuff them inside. Okay, I've got some rosemary. Got some homegrown bay leaves that my mom grew. Okay, put some thyme and even some mint. Now, depending on what kind of chicken, if you're doing like a Greek chicken, stuff it with a bunch of mint, and then you can serve it with kind of a lemon yogurt sauce. I've got the garlic. I'm just going to cut the garlic in half, and I'm going to put half of it kind of at the entrance of the chicken, towards the back. If I put it all the way inside, it wouldn't get roasty because it would be insulated by the rest of the chicken. This way, it's going to kind of get a roasty flavor and perfume the bird. And then the other half, what I'm going to do is I'm going to put that in the pan. Okay, then you just kind of twist these little arms under, so it looks like it's laying out for a suntan. And then a lot of people will truss a chicken. That means that they'll tie the legs together, kind of cross the legs. But I think that it cooks quicker if you leave it open because that exposes the thighs. But if you want to make a real pretty bird, you could always cross the legs. You can either stick a toothpick or a skewer through there or tie it with twine. So basically, you know, that's the way that your chicken looks before you put it in the oven. We're going to take it over here. I'm going to just rub it with a little bit of oil, just kind of giving it a nice little like suntan lotion, rub it on there, a little coating of kosher salt, a little bit of crushed pepper, and then I'm going to also rub a little bit of chopped garlic on the outside of the skin. Now you want to rub this in, kind of give it a nice massage, and then if you want to, you could also season a little bit on the inside of the cavity. I'm using a little bit of my Greek garlic spice rub, but you could use any of your favorite seasonings. All right, and now the bird's ready to take over to the oven. Now, a lot of people don't do this step, but I think it's pretty important. We've got a hot pan on. Okay, we're going to put this guy breast side down in the pan. Okay, what this does is it helps develop a really nice crispy skin. Flip it over.
So you're just getting some char on the skin with this.
Well, we're doing that, but what we're also doing is we're building kind of a caramelized crust on the bottom of the pan, and that will give us a nice juice at the end to use as a sauce. Okay, you have a little bit of that lemon juice and herbs and stuff left on your platter that you were massaging and seasoning the chicken on. You can dump those in, and then you could use either white wine or water or a combination or even chicken stock. Okay, and we're going to put about an eighth to a quarter inch of water in there. What that's done is it's released the fond or the caramelization of the pan, and it's also going to keep your chicken from burning. It's going to make your pan easier to clean up after roasting because it won't have all that stuff stuck to it. All right, now we put this in a 450-degree oven for 15 minutes. Then we're going to turn it down to 325 and cook it an additional half an hour, and we'll come back in about 45 minutes. slice you off a little taste. Are you a dark meat lady or a white meat lady?
Well, I'm normally light meat, but let's go with the dark meat. The really tasty stuff.
Okay, dip it in that juice. Moist.
Oh,
you can taste the garlic, the lemons in there, the rosemary, the fresh herbs. And again, use whatever you want. If you like to go like, let's say, a Southwestern style, you could, instead of the regular seasoning, you could use a little chili powder on it, throw a bunch of cilantro and limes in it, and all of a sudden you've got kind of a Mexican chicken. You could rub some curry on it and serve with yogurt sauce. You've got an Indian chicken. You can take it all over the world just by using different seasonings.
And it's slightly pink. It's the perfect type of pink.
A little bit of pink at the bone, as long as, you know, you've got a fresh local chicken, is fine. Usually the local chickens have been running around. They use their muscles. They use their joints more. And, you know, so there's naturally going to be a chance to have a little bit of pink there. Okay, I'll slice you a little bit of the breast.
Oh, my goodness. It's so juicy. I think this is the best chicken I've ever tasted. We kept picking at that chicken until we had nearly eaten it all. It was so good. See photos of the bird and check out the recipe so you can cook the perfect roast chicken in your own kitchen. Our website is eartheats.org.
Support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods Market and Deli. Information at bloomingfoods.coop.
Production support also comes from goodsforcooks.com, online at goodsforcooks.com.
Earth Eats is a production of WFIU Public Media. Thanks for listening. I'm Chef Daniel Orr.
And I'm Annie Corrigan. See you next time.